WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Oh, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth,
very
Charlie
good.
Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Thank you for keeping your radio dial set here for Monday Night Talk. Welcome to the program. Feels good to be back. I had a little bit of a hiatus over the weekend. I took myself down to D.C. and visited an old friend. And actually, it's actually one of our segments tonight, catching up with former WATD newsman Steve Burns, hanging out with him over the weekend. And during that time, thought it would be a perfect opportunity to talk one-on-one with him. We know we have him on as the D.C. correspondent. It's kind of a fond title because he's down there. He's on boots on the ground, and thought it'd be cool to tape a segment with Steve and air it here on the program. That's coming up at 7 o'clock. Of course, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself here. We'll start things off after we check traffic with we'll speak with State Rep Jim Cantwell. Of course, that's our... It's one of my favorite segments. The State House Report gives us an opportunity to speak with folks at the State House. Sometimes on the local level, we may speak to a mayor or somebody who is on a board of selectmen, but it is devised to speak with folks, state senators, state representatives. Maybe we might get a constitutional officer or two from time to time. But I like to have an opportunity to speak with the local legislative delegation here on the South Shore, not necessarily for one particular community. Tonight, it's Representative Jim Cantwell. He will join me. We'll talk a little bit about National Flood Insurance Program, the renewal, the importance of it, especially for a lot of the coastal communities that we have down here on the South Shore, how important it is that program gets extended in light of the natural disasters that we have seen down in Texas, the Gulf Coast, Florida, Puerto Rico, just to name a few different areas. We'll also talk with Jim about a few other things that he's working on, especially in the areas of the opioid epidemic. Once we get done with speaking with the representative, we have a gentleman who used to be a part of the Boston Globe Spotlight investigative team turned author, Dick Lair, will join me. Dick, co-author of Black Mask. You remember that book turned into a movie starring Johnny Depp? Well, Dick is at it again, as he has a new book, Trell. We'll talk a little bit about that. We'll talk a little bit about the press, too, and his thoughts as to how the media is perceived these days, seeing that he's a guy who, you know, that's how he got started before he became an author, a well-known author. He was somebody who, you know, was out there doing reporting. Get his take on that. And then, as I said, I teased as we open up the show to the segment with the taped segment with Steve Burns at the WMAL studios in Washington, D.C. And then we have two great segments. We have Holly Brown, executive director of Looking and Feeling Fab. They got an upcoming event. And Melita Arredondo, executive director of the Arredondo Family Foundation, talk a little bit about Suicide Prevention Month. That's what September is, Suicide Prevention Month, and talk a little bit about the foundation and get an idea as to their story and what's going on. So that is coming up in tonight's program. So please stay tuned for that.
I love this time of year. Rustling leaves, a crisp wind blowing, apple picking for homemade apple pie, a sunny day in a corn maze, a bonfire on a cool night. Cigars, and a half gallon of hot apple cider. Apple pie. We made it ourselves. This has nothing to do with Brennan's Smoke Shop, but everything to do with life. It's short, yet so sweet. Kind of like pumpkin spice coffee. It comes and goes like autumn wind. Brennan's Smoke Shop. Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, and now on Pope's Island in New Bedford. Brennan's Smoke Shop, the very best smoke shop in Massachusetts. Customers must have a valid state or federal ID to enter the store. Message me on Facebook.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
We are back here on Monday Night Talk, and thank you for keeping your radio dial set here. First up this evening is State Representative Jim Campbell. No, he is not my co-host like he was a couple of weeks ago, but it was fun to have the representative kind of sit in. He's one of a few. It's almost like, you know, like you watch Saturday Night Live, and the dude like to skit about the hosts who've like hosted like five times, like Steve Martin and Justin Timberlake. Almost like you have joined an exclusive club.
I like that. You will have to get those jackets that have the numbers on them. Then they'll be perfect.
And I am an elected official that has co-hosted Monday Night Live. That's very right. Few who have done it, but we have a number of things that sure. I wanted to have you in to kind of chat a little bit about. I think I want to start off our conversation talking a little bit about a big event that one of our media partners,
PAC TV,
as they did the telethon.
It was a telethon. We had the Give Hope telethon just this past Saturday night, raised $25,000 so far to help people who were victims of the hurricanes down in both Texas and in Florida, and hopefully we'll be able to see about helping people in Puerto Rico and throughout. An unbelievable night, Kevin, that PAC TV, and by the way, Marshall Community Television was one of the affiliates that was live broadcasting. People who were present there. Matt Muraturi, my colleague from Plymouth, was one of the co-hosts there who helped to bring Tom Coulter came, Tom O'Brien, Josh Cutler, myself, all of us made sure that
the law firm was there.
Yes, the three C's.
The law firm of?
Cutler, Cantwell, and Coulter. We kind of rotated around.
I thought you were going to instantly go Cantwell, Cutler, and
we did that. We will do that when we're trying to rib one another. But you know, there are also times that we note the folks who do a great work all around. And Muraturi, we have to throw in there. So it'll be the three C's and M. So
I definitely like that. And a successful night. And folks may remember the podcast is up because we had Donna Rodriguez,
yes,
who is an outreach coordinator for PAC TV, along with Dr. Gary Maestas. He was the superintendent of Plymouth Schools. And the understanding was the monies go
100%
towards, right, Rotarians right. Down, I think, in the area will make sure that they distribute the money. So if you're still trying to decide whether you want to contribute, I suggest that you go on to PAC TV's website.
That's exactly what I was looking at, www.pactv.org, and you'll see it has a link for how to donate. So pactv.org.
Look at that. It's like the, you know, the public service announcement that just keeps giving. But what was your role? Were you just kind of there to kind of help out, answer phones? Did you do any stand-ups?
Donna had me come in to talk just about flood insurance, about what the impacts, coastal resiliency, what we're trying and have been doing here in Massachusetts. We had the lieutenant governor call in and talked about when she came to Marshfield and Scituate just after getting elected several years ago, when we had back in 2015 with some of the heavy nor'easters that we had in our area in the record snowfall. So it was, for us, you know, one of the lessons for us is knowing that when we're in need, it makes a big difference. And we had trucks from other utilities that came from around the country that came to help get our power back on. I remember thanking and feeding guys from Tennessee, from Alabama, and the like. So, you know, now it's our turn to make sure when another part of the country has been hard hit, not only for official utilities going, but for citizens doing as much as we can to try to help raise funds. And the Rotarians down in Plymouth have done a phenomenal job working with PAC TV and others to make sure that we are raising those funds.
Now, it was interesting enough, a couple of weeks ago, I had Joe Rossi, who is a guy who he actually does insurance. He's part of the Citizens Coastal Coalition in Marshfield. He chairs that and does a great job. Every time I turn around, I'm talking to him. He's running off to one conference to another to kind of talk about it. Is it kind of interesting that we see these events take place, these natural disasters taking place? And the conversation that I was having with Joe at that particular time was in regards to the renewal of the National Flood Insurance Program.
Yes.
And I think you had actually, during the program at one particular time, you might even sent me a message going, yeah, Kevin, I think they are. Do you think this kind of will fast-track the process to at least renew it and turn around because of what has happened in Florida and the Gulf Coast and Puerto Rico?
I think so. I think, you know, sadly, it takes these types of natural disasters to make people realize how important it is for the federal government to be there with a helping hand. I think, what's the word for it? It's ironic that the leading critic, the critic of the National Flood Insurance Program was a congressman from Texas who wanted to either eliminate it or make it far less, I think, viable, and wanted to push it to be private insurers. Since these hurricanes have hit, I think
second
that's...
Second thoughts, maybe?
Yes, yeah, as a whole. And look, when they had... not to, you know, no one should ever play politics with these things. It's a program that was incredibly successful from 1968 right up until Hurricane Katrina, turned a $10 billion profit up back to that point. But we know now there's a challenge. It is clearly the program prior to these two most recent hurricanes hitting was $25 billion in debt. Now the numbers could quadruple. So the lesson, one of the things that we're looking for the National Flood Insurance Program to be reauthorized, it would have expired September 30th.
Correct.
Congress, in having some of the funds that are being sent for Texas, they reauthorize it till December 8th. Hopefully by that period of time, they'll come up with some solutions. What we need to see for good public policy is, number one, they need to invest more in mitigation. We see for every $1 that gets spent for mitigation, we save $4 or $5 for damage that gets done after the fact. So the federal government, through this program, should reward communities and individuals who want to be investing in mitigation. The second is for mapping. Mapping has to be done accurately, so we know where you would think a 100-year storm where water will reach. But here's the lesson from the most recent storms, Kevin, is that water is reaching areas that they never thought would flood, which gets to a third point, is membership. We have 5 million people right now nationally that are in the National Flood Insurance Program. In all honesty, that number should grow, but they have to make it affordable, which is the fourth of the 4 points, that if they have introductory rates and people can get flood insurance for $200 for their home and it would cover them for the $250,000, that is a good investment for folks. It's when rates get to climb to be $68,000 a year, which is what happened to constituents of mine out in Scituate, that the program starts to fail because people pull out and say they just won't pay for it. So I think looking to the future, we really should have a national hazard insurance program that can help when certainly if there are hurricanes that strike. But don't forget, we have Tornado Alley in Oklahoma. We have wildfires that take place out in Colorado, Arizona. We have mudslides that take place out in California. We have our storms that hit here. We really are going to need we're all in this together type approach to make sure that we can all invest in ways to help those who get most hard hit.
I guess the other question that I would ask you is, you say December 8th. Do you feel that they need to fully reauthorize it? Do you feel that they need to institute further amendments? I'm thankful that they're looking at this. They looked at it and they decided to extend it. But are there going to need to be any big changes in order to extend this for a longer period of time instead of us having to worry that, uh-oh, we get another deadline.
You're right.
Fast approaching.
You're right. Now, and that's one we had. We just did a program at the State House on September 13th, where I was pleased to have congressional staff, the experts from Senator Warren's office, Senator Markey's office, Congressman Keating, and Congressman Lynch, all come to give us an idea of what was happening up to that point legislatively. You are absolutely right. December 8th, it's such a short window that in order to do comprehensive reforms might be difficult to fully vet them. The ask that we have, anyone who wants to buy a home or anyone that's trying to get a loan, you need certainty. And you need it to be for a long period of time. They really do need this program to be reauthorized. Some of the proposals are 6 or 8 years. It would make sense to reauthorize it and then perhaps do some reforms to the program as they're seeing the evidence that's coming in from other areas of the country. But I would think hand in hand for right now, the 4 points I was pointing out, invest in mitigation, get accurate mapping, make sure that we increase membership, but make the program affordable. Those being the four goals, I was pleased that the staff members who were there, and just to give a shout out to them, Connor Hyland from Senator Warren's office, Chris Matthews is Congressman Keating, Shana Barnes is Congressman Lynch, Rory Clark from Senator Markey's office. They all did a phenomenal job talking about how their respective bosses were 100% behind the effort to reauthorize.
Okay, we're speaking with State Representative Jim Cantwell, of course, representing the 4th Plymouth District. He does so proudly, Marshfield and parts of Situate. It isn't all of Situate,
We don't discern lines, but for me, all of Situate, but I share and proud to share it with Joan Moschino. She formally represents Precinct 3, but we share.
How is the freshman doing?
She's doing great, and she was one of the leading people at this forum. We had over 50 legislators in their offices there from around the state, by the way, making the point that this is not just a coastal program. Anywhere there's water that touches homes. We had a few years ago with reauthorization, Jack Conway's folk, Carol Conway, came in and talked of homes that were falling, that wouldn't close in Brockton because they were near water. We had people, Smitty Pignatelli represents Lenox, and he was there the other day talking of the difficulties there. We had Carolyn Dykema has Holliston, that area. Jay Barrows represents Foxborough. Everyone giving examples for how they saw constituents who had loans fall through because they didn't realize that they were in a flood zone and some of the rates were pretty exorbitant.
Usually, again, the idea of this segment featuring state representatives, state senators, gives an opportunity to talk about other things. Again, we've kind of knocked a couple out of the park real quick, talking a little bit about the telethon, talking a little bit about the extension of the flood insurance program, the National Flood Insurance Program. You've been working on so many different things. I know that you're also sitting on a committee. You might even chair the committee in regards to the opioid epidemic,
right,
and the issues,
yes,
with that. And remind folks the name of that committee.
We call it, colloquially, it's the Promote Prevent Commission.
Correct.
Group of 24 experts, folks who are public health experts, public safety experts, people from the jails, people who are out at the hospitals. We just had folks from Beth Israel Deaconess come in, looking to find ways to move upstream. We talk right now in the area of substance abuse and for mental health conditions, we typically we react. So we spend 96% of the dollars that are in the state budget, and this is proven even for the federal budgets. Money gets spent downstream after someone has shown that they could have an addiction. So we have great people that will do recovery coaches, will go right to their home, or they'll have people at South Shore Hospital or Beth Israel Deaconess will make sure to revive the people and make them healthy again. You'll have long-term treatment, recovery, jails, sheriffs, all those funds spent downstream. We want to move up and find ways with evidence-based programs that can help make a more resilient person, show young kids about the importance of what they put into their bodies, help people so that if they are in need of outpatient services, we do those early before someone either has a behavioral health condition, or which includes substance abuse. One statistic, Kevin, at any given time in the United States, in any given year, 1 in 4 Americans will have a behavioral health condition. It could be depression. We just did a forum, as you know, on preventing suicide.
Correct.
Could be depression, could be anorexia, could be anxiety, could be substance abuse. And this commission is doing great work trying to find ways that we can work in our communities to make more resilient communities, prevent harm in the first place, and thrilled about some of the successes that we're having already.
I think a lot of the different things that over the past number of years, since folks really realized that an epidemic was upon us,
right,
as a culture, was the idea of how to tackle this, how to get treatment, how to, if somebody was or is suffering from addiction, that it wasn't something that they should be penalized. There'd be a certain course of action to take place instead of just sticking them in jail.
Right.
You know, we got drug courts and stuff like that. We've come a long way over the past number of years to try to at least try to find ways to attack this issue. Where do you feel that we have progressed to at this point when it comes to drug addiction? Is it a matter of that we're still trying to refine treatment and we're still trying to educate? So at least it's something, and you mentioned it, where you're the younger people, you want to kind of give them an idea as to knowing what they're putting in their body and how it will affect them long term.
Right. Well, I'm going to be leaving here tonight and going to a meeting over at the Marshfield, it is the Marshfield School Administration Building. There's a meeting of Marshfield FACTS where it's families, adolescents, communities together against substances, where we're making great inroads. There will be a presentation of the Youth Risk Behavior Survey showing about, because of efforts of community coalitions on the South Shore, that the use of alcohol among young people has been declining. It was a fact that the use of marijuana was declining, but now they're finding already just the perception of risk has totally changed. So that's going to go right back up again. Use of cigarettes declining. The real concern is for vaping. Vaping now, 75% of Marshfield High School students have reported that they've either themselves vaped or been with other people. That's going to be, for education purposes, we're going to have a lot of work to do to make sure that we're showing about what the public health concerns can be there. It is a marked change just in my short time being a state representative. When we've had police chiefs Phil Tavares and Mike Stewart, Marshfield and Scituate, respectfully, both of them saying that we're not going to arrest our way out of this problem, that this is a public health crisis, that we need to be able to work to educate people. What are the warning signs to look for when children may be acting differently, to know if they're using? What are the conversations parents need to have with their kids about the real risks of marijuana? Right now, South Shore Facts is a program at the Hanover Mall that talks of the myths of marijuana to show people that the effects are far greater than they were when you and I were kids. Mm. You know, I know I'm much, much older than you, but it is a different world.
Oh, no, yeah, absolutely. Tell me if I'm correct here, but I think of like the Cheech and Chong days,
right,
when, you know, the marijuana wasn't the same strength it is these days.
You're
where
right.
It has been cross-pollinated to try to get the most THC out of a plant,
right,
and of course gain, you know, a significant high out of it. And it's interesting that you kind of put it that way, because there can be an argument made for, and I've heard the argument, I've heard people try to argue on both sides of the issue whether or not marijuana is a gateway drug. And some people will tell you, yes, it is. Not necessarily the clinicians who will tell you that it is, but people who are users themselves will say, well, that's how we started. They started, right, you know, I made the transfer from one high to another.
Understood. And for folks where people get tripped up sometimes about what labels they want to use, it is clear that if you're making decisions, young people right up to age 25, their brains are still developing,
yep,
and they're going to take more risks. And the longer we can convince young people to not use a substance, whatever it will be, the substance of choice, the better our chances are that they won't be lifelong addicts. The statistics are pretty startling that if someone drinks or uses marijuana before the age of 16, they are like 400% more likely to have lifetime addiction issues. If that delay goes until age 21, it drops down to about 20% of a chance. So it's an interesting, the statistics. I'm going to be sitting through a program with Dr. Joe Schran tomorrow morning. Tuesday morning, he's going to be doing the presentation to South Shore Facts at a program at Lantana's to, I think there are 20 different community coalitions that will be hearing his presentation about the realities of marijuana legalization, what things we need to be looking for, and how we need to make sure people, if they are going to use marijuana, they're doing it responsibly.
Joe, one of the co-creators of Drug Story Theater,
yes,
where they actually use folks who have, you know, have dealt with addiction and tell their story, you know, as they're, you know, clean and sober individuals, to get on stage and be able to speak to their peers about, hey, this is how I got into it. You want to avoid being like me.
Absolutely.
Very,
so.
Very interesting.
It's really powerful because the studies that we do for young students going in before they hear the program and then after, because Joe is just, he's so very thoughtful. To have five young people who now are addicted and they're addicted to heavy drugs, but that now they're in a period of remission and hopefully lifelong recovery, but to have them through art, through theater, talk about how they first had their first use of a drug, what that did to them personally, what it did to their families, what it's done to their whole, for their whole future. The study after they ask children first, when they go in, they have them say, what do you think the risks are for marijuana use? And the numbers are 75% say it's no big deal. Mm-hmm. After the program, it flips. So I think, you know, for education, that is our responsibility. Voters spoke. Voters believe that there should be legalization of marijuana. We've done, and the legislature did, a number of things to try to outlaw what we saw that could be most harmful, these edible products that could look just like candy.
Gummy things bears
Right, those types
it's
of things.
Very deceptive.
They certainly can be. If there is a silver lining for the legalization, it's hopefully that you won't see what has happened recently is simple marijuana, but getting laced with fentanyl. There have been a number of those episodes. So the only silver lining that I would say, anytime you make something, if we can, you're not going to eliminate the black market for sure. And indeed, allowing people to grow up to 12 plants in their home makes one think that there may be a very active black market to come. But if we give people a safe place where they can be able to buy this new drug legally and that they'll know what's in it, hopefully we will be able to reduce the levels of addiction that will be out there.
Again, you're listening to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. And my guest friend, State Representative Jim Cantwell, kind of just giving him the floor to kind of talk about some of the things that he's been working on in the district. And right now we're kind of talking a little bit about, a committee that he helps chair to kind of help prevent, promote positive ways to kind of help folks who are dealing with addiction. I got to throw it out there at you, Representative, while we have you for the next couple of moments.
Sure.
And that is, you know, we've talked about the addiction, you know, especially with like prescription drugs, Oxycontin, oxycodone. We talked about marijuana and the fear of folks using that as a gateway drug. And you mentioned it just a couple of moments earlier. You know, you get the edibles for marijuana hemp or whatever you want to call it, that is turned into, you know, used on other products, whether it's edible stuff. And you mentioned fentanyl. And that's like the next major thing that I fear is going to be a problem. And it's not necessarily just the people who are using that, but it's those emergencies, those public safety individuals who go and realize that it's in the air, carfentanil's in the air, and that they themselves become
overdose. Right.
What do you think will need to be done down the road, whether it's legislatively or needs to be done in order to kind of, you know, eliminate this threat?
Right. I think if we look to ways that we legislatively made changes when we were concerned about meth coming across the country, and all of a sudden federal legislation, people realized that when you went in to get certain types of cough medicines or other you had to show your ID, and people were like, what's that for? Well, that was, they were trying to track who was buying these things, crushing them up, using them to try to get to the heart of the carfentanil. These are very sinister people who are creating these substances who, as you were pointing out, it's the statistic, I don't know if it's 10 times, 100 times more potent than fentanyl. What is known is a tiny amount that could just fit almost like a little salt on your finger is enough for someone to overdose. It is a poison. So people who are acting in selling and creating carfentanil, absolutely, those are the few folks when we talk about people that would have mandatory minimum sentences, they are, and some of them were caught on tape and up in Lawrence joking about saying how many people were going to get killed by them mixing the stuff in. Here's the other stuff for our police. fire. Folks at the front lines, they now, as you were referencing, they have to be so careful. Where it used to be, they'd maybe test to see, put your finger in, test it.
Anymore.
You can't, because we have people at the front lines protecting you and I. Now they're doing a bust, and they have to be careful of how they even touch these substances.
It's like a hazmat situation.
It absolutely is. Mm-hmm. We have our drug dogs who have been overdosed occasionally. It is bad. So here, but I think it comes back to education. Early on, that we're saying, for you, don't put these things in your body. We're going to be teaching kids at the youngest ages of healthy eating, healthy exercise, and the like. Then as they get a little older, talk about some of these drugs that they see. As they get a little older, it's to educate people. Kids who play sports. Right now, we know just last night, actually, the Sports Exchange was on, and they had a bunch of sports kids who were talking. And when they play sports hard, we want to be careful that you get an injury and you're not prescribed an opiate that could lead to lifelong addiction. There's a lot of work to be done, but I'm pleased to say with our social delegation working with his administration, we have people that are doing a great job with both state legislation and working with our local boards of health and local community coalitions. We're making a difference.
And we appreciate you coming in on this, whether it's doing this program, Monday Night Talk. I know that you're a regular contributor to the news department and South Shore Morning News, and we appreciate the assistance of elected leaders on all levels to at least have that ongoing, sharing of information with a community radio station like this. Before I let you go, just real quick, Mr. Steve Burns, who we're going to hear
later tonight.
Just in a bit, we'll hear him in just a bit. Wanted to make sure that I extended a hello to you and thought it was very astute of you to notice that as I was spending time with him this past weekend, why he was not wearing an A's hat.
I always knew him to be a major athletics fan, so I look forward to hearing just in a few minutes for his comments, and my son's looking at colleges in Washington, so I'll have to look Steve up. We'll let Steve know that we'll come down and check out him on air and visit the wonderful city of Washington.
There he is. None other than State Representative Jim Cantwell being our guest this evening. We're going to step aside for a few moments. When we come back, more program right here on 95.9 WATD. Don't go in.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
How much of a difference could the new cancer center at Signature Healthcare make in your life? The difference of getting all the advanced care you need in one location, right here in your community. The difference of having your own personalized cancer care team, covering every aspect of your treatment, with access to national clinical trials. The difference of Harvard-affiliated oncologists working hand-in-hand with colleagues from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center.
I'm Dr. Rolf Frater, Chief of Hematology and Oncology at the Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare. Here, we'll schedule your first appointment within a day so you can get started on your treatment right away. That's one of the ways the Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare is making a difference every day.
To learn more about the difference we can make in your life, visit our website, mysignaturecare.org/cancercare. The Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare, affiliated with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. We have a fantastic guest. We, from time to time, like to have an opportunity to speak with folks who are in our field. So happens that our guest for this segment happens to be somebody who is part of a former reporter from the Boston Globe's famous Spotlight team, and is also an author. We have joining us right now Dick Lehr. He is professor of journalism and also a gentleman who is a Pulitzer Prize finalist and also a co-author Remember that movie, The Black Mass? Who was a co-author of that? It got turned into a movie. You folks remember. Mr. Lair, welcome to Monday Night Talk, sir.
Hey, Kevin.
So the premise of having you on here isn't to talk about your journalism background. It isn't to talk about the movie that was, you know, the book that was made into a movie, but to talk about a new book that you're working, Trell. Am I saying that correctly?
That's right. That's the girl's name, Trell. No, it's a new direction for me in the sense that it's a fiction. It's a novel for young adults built around a girl named Trell from Roxbury, a neighborhood of Boston.
So area of town that you might have covered from time to time? Yes, no?
Absolutely. For many years I was at the Globe. I did a lot of stories, investigative pieces involving, you know, police and policing in the city. And in fact, it was a case that I investigated of wrongful conviction in a murder some of your listeners may remember from the late 80s that became known, the murder of Tiffany Moore, the girl on the blue mailbox.
Mm.
That became the inspiration for this novel for young adults, you know, with Trell as a protagonist, working with a journalist, a reporter from the Boston Globe, on a mystery.
My question to you is, and while you've already got one book behind you, how have you had to tweak your writing style? Because it's a different way, a different approach when it comes to writing for whether it's breaking news or a feature story compared to, you know, long form writing.
Oh yeah, yeah, no, and in fact, I've actually written 6 or 7 books, and they're all nonfiction. This is my first time wading into the waters of fiction.
Mm.
Yes, and up until now, and most of my writing is fact based. That's the big thing. Journalism, you know, we're obsessed with facts. We're obsessed with verifying any information we get, and publishing to the best of our ability what we know is the truth. When I shifted gears here to write Trell, because I wanted to try something different, get outside my usual comfort zone as a writer, and I also wanted to, in writing for a younger audience, I was looking for a way to write about some of these issues that have informed my journalism, meaning, you know, an interest in criminal justice matters and revealing the imperfections of our institutions. I wanted to find a way to write about those themes for a younger audience. And that it was in that mix that I said, well, let me take a shot at writing a novel. And I didn't do it, like I say, without a safety net. And the safety net was sort of playing off a real case that I had written about for the Globe, and using that as kind of my scaffolding, and then taking off from there to come up with plot, characters, drama. As this girl named Trell works with a reporter, and there are forces in the neighborhood who don't want them digging up the past, and creating all that suspense and drama. It was both challenging, but then in some ways liberating. It was a really neat project.
And the interesting twist here is the how you've spun the story is something that has been taking place in America these days, where a young African-American man was apprehended, charged, and wrongly convicted. While this may be a fictional tale, this is actually something that's transpiring today in Americana.
Right, absolutely. And that's, you know, again, that's why part of me is wanting to, again, work these themes, these issues, for a different audience, a younger audience. All the work, you know, the stories I worked on at the Globe and the pieces, you know, even the real case, I mean, it's largely an adult audience, and that's important. But what about, you know, a story that appeals to an issue near and dear to my heart, which is the power of journalism? I mean, this partnership between the girl, Trell, and the reporter from the Globe, they're working as journalists, working, and the legal appeals have failed for her family. And the only thing left is trying to get a reporter going, and that's what Trell does. And then they team up, and it's a drama, but like I keep saying, or want to say to kids, is like, this is a story showcasing what the difference that journalism can make and how important it is in a free society. I get all high-minded, but, you know, there's no preaching going on in the novel itself, but that's the subtext, that's the theme.
Well, the idea, you mean you have, you know, targeting that demographic, impressionable minds, this could be something that stays with them for the rest of their lives. So I can see how planting the seed could be something that helps them as they grow and as they become the future leaders of our country.
Yeah, no, that's sort of the hope and the motive, and I think part of how I came even to undertaking this project is the fact that I have been teaching journalism at BU now for more than a decade, and seeing college-age students who are, you know, aspiring journalists to get all fired up over these same issues, and seeing how important it is to talk about this stuff and talk about the importance of accountability and watchdog journalism, and then thinking, okay, let me find a way to take it a notch down, again, high school and middle school, and that was all kind of in the gestalt of, like, say, well, I'm going to write this novel, you know, called Trowel.
Yeah, we're speaking with Dick Lehr. He is author of the page-turning novel Trowel, which is in bookstores near you. I believe is it available online as well?
Yeah, Kindle and whatnot, sure. I think there's an audio, one of the CDs versions as well.
Being a journalist myself, you being one for nearly two decades, being somebody who now teaches, you know, the tools of your trade to the next generation of journalists, when you hear the term fake news, or you see bloggers out there putting out half-truths, how does that, you as a professional, how does that make you feel?
Well, it makes me angry. I know that's, you know, one response, and then the other is how you know, it just, you know, reinforces the importance of training not only, you know, the next generation of journalists to double down and to make sure that, you know, what we do produce, the news we produce is verified to the best of our ability. And then it also requires us as a whole, as a society, and I've been reading about how they're trying to build this into curriculums now, is training consumers of news and information or misinformation. You know, when we're all hit with this stuff, is training us to be, in some ways, have our inner journalist, develop an inner journalist muscle, in the sense that we don't believe everything that comes at us on social media, and learning how, in a quick side way or whatever it is, to be a little skeptical and say, wait, should I believe this? Have something go off in your head. Should I believe this? Not just like, oh, wow, this is amazing, and believe it. And to come up with ways in which to do a quick check. Where is this coming from? Is this a reliable source? Or if it's not, it may be true, but if I click over here, I can find out whether it's true or not. You know, it's a bigger challenge, but I think, you know, there are ways in which we can start to develop what I call the inner journalist muscle in all of us, you know, to come into play in terms of processing all that stuff that comes at us.
Where does your frustration go when it comes to, you know, our elected leaders like Donald Trump, who will call certain reports that aren't favorable towards him fake news? I mean, wouldn't you think that when it comes to putting out information or being somebody like a Donald Trump, who's used to being in front of the cameras, who's used to being a reality celebrity, that it starts at the top? I mean, isn't that where it has to be when it comes to fake news and having a message put out there?
Yeah, no, it's unfortunate that this kind of confusion and chaos and does start at the top. And, it, you know, what journalists and the public can do is just continue to, you know, go this straight ahead, and for journalism, whatever the site is, if it's, you know, online or whatnot, is to continue to, you know, sort of restate the mission of journalism and the importance of journalism, and the aspirations is to not participate in fake news. And it doesn't mean, you know, the New York Times is perfect or any newspaper or the Post or the Boston Globe, but to, you know, when mistakes are made, to be transparent about it. This is how it happened, and hopefully it doesn't happen again. But that's all how you build credibility and reliability. But I think it's important to just continue to, in ways we haven't had to in the past, for journalism to describe, you know, again, its mission and its role. And in some ways, I'm doing that in Trowel. I mean, because that is one of the themes. To illustrate, to dramatize the importance of
knowing the success of Black Mass being written, turned into a screenplay and then a movie, is Atrell on that same track? Does it have an opportunity to maybe be something on a bigger medium? A larger
well, movie? It certainly has that opportunity because, you know, and this is, you know, luck, you know, good fortune and whatnot, but even before the book came out last week, a production, a film company has optioned its film rights. So that's that first step towards a possible movie. So, you know, that's good news.
If folks wanted to follow you in regards to any of the books that you have written, any of the things that you're working on, how can they do that, and how can they find out more information in regards to your new book, Trell?
Well, my publisher is Candlewick Press, which is actually here in the Boston area in Somerville, and they're just one of the leading publishers of you know, kid-led and young adult literature. So I would steer people there, and also I have a website, dicklaird.com, which isn't up to date in terms of Trell, but because Trell just came out, but it has all the other books I've done, including Black Mass.
Now, are you anticipating any big book signings in the Boston area? You're going to be traveling the country as well.
Yeah, a little bit of that. I don't have it in front of me, but there are a calendar of events upcoming, both around this area and also elsewhere. I know I'm going to Washington D.C. and Virginia in a couple of weeks.
Well, I want to thank you, Mr. Lair, for being my guest, and I wish you all the success that comes with putting together a book like this, being a professional like yourself, and it, already seeing success previously, and I hope to speak with you down the road somewhere.
That'd be great. Thanks, Kevin.
There he is, Mr. Dick Lair, a former reporter with the Boston Globe's famous Spotlight team, now has a new book out, Trell. If you have a chance, check it out. Available on Kindle online, and also check out his website. Well, as we get ready to take a break, I just want to kind of tease our second hour, actually our next segment, which was, it's a taped segment, but it was taped down in D.C. This past weekend, as I had a chance to sit down with former WATD newsman Steve Burns, who has since moved to the nation's capital, works for WMAL, 630 AM, 105.9 FM. Had a chance to tour the city, go to a couple of sporting events, and sit down and talk with him, catch up with him since the last time we had him on here on this program. It was actually a phone-in conversation, so of course the conversation is going to be cleaner because it's person to person. He's on mic, and we get to talk with him. So stay tuned for that. That's coming up in just a few moments right here on Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
How much of a difference could the new cancer center at Signature Healthcare make in your life? The difference of getting all the advanced care you need in one location, right here in your community. The difference of having your own personalized cancer care team, covering every aspect of your treatment with access to national clinical trials. The difference of scheduling your first appointment within a day so you can get started on your treatment right away.
I'm Dr. Stephen Lane, Chief of Radiation Oncology at the Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare. Here we deliver world-class care right in your community with Harvard-affiliated physicians working hand-in-hand with specialists from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. That's one of the ways the Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare is making a difference every day.
To learn more about the difference we could make in your life, visit our website, mysignaturecare.org/cancercare. The Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare, affiliated with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. The South Shore's breaking news, weather, and traffic station.
95.9 WATD-FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com. Follow Monday Night Talk on Twitter. Start at 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add hashtag Monday Night Talk to your tweets. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
Welcome back to the second hour of Monday Night Talk. And this portion of the program, at least the next 20, 25 minutes, actually, it's Memorex. It's being taped. It's been taped at the studios, the WMAL studios, 6:30 a.m., 105.9 FM. And it's an opportunity for me to catch up with a gentleman that you know from his time in our illustrious news department, none other than, I fondly call him the DC correspondent, because he's been so kind to lend his talents to our program, especially since the onset of the new administration, Donald Trump taking office. Joining me is none other than Mr. Steve Burns.
It's a pleasure to have you here in my home for a change. This is important to note, those FM and AM call letters can only be heard in the Washington, D.C. area. But it's a pleasure to have you here in D.C. It's a pleasure to be hosting this segment of Monday Night Talk for you. Welcome.
I want to say, first and foremost, since the last time you and I had an opportunity to have a conversation, I've liked having you as kind of a component where we can put something together, and you're kind of like the boots on the ground. You're sharing the information that you're sharing with, Washingtonians? Or
Washingtonians, yes.
Washingtonians.
The trendy thing is the DMV, the District, Maryland, and Virginia.
You take this information in and you share it with your listeners, and being able to at least share it with another audience, a secondary audience, is very cool. Here we are, going on 10 months into the year. What has it been like for you in regards to this new administration and dealing with, you know, being a news guy out and about and dealing with, because the world has changed, I feel,
sure.
since the beginning of the year.
It's kind of transformed what I do. I mean, my job description here at WMAL is to be the local news correspondent. I came in here with the full knowledge that I probably would not be spending much time at the White House or the Capitol or talking to congressmen or senators or anything. I'd be more doing local news, like talking to D.C.'s mayor, talking to local county council members and the police and the fire and all that stuff. And that's what I wanted to do. I'm fine with that. But then everything sort of changed here on January 20th. There were things that were said that were a lot more controversial. When that kind of thing happens at the national level, especially when what happens locally is always so attached to the national level here, given that there's so many federal employees, so many federal employers. So when something happens controversially at the national level, it has a ripple effect down to the local levels here. That's where my job came in. And now it has since become a lot of different iterations of getting reactions to things that this administration has done and said that have been more controversial than in the past, and it's kind of seeped into my job a lot more than what had been happening before.
Do you feel as though sometimes you have to get, instead of going with a main story, you're trying to get second and third tier? You're trying to find different ways to develop the story in
right.
regards to what's going on, and kind of getting a man in the street type of a feel?
Right, yeah. It's just sort of getting a reaction, because there's a ripple effect. I mean, that's really the best way to put it, is everything here hinges on the federal government, because there's so many federal employees here. The economy of Washington, D.C. is the federal government. If it were to go away, then D.C. would just crumble, basically. So whatever happens here, it's kind of a ripple effect off the federal government. So say, for example, the most recent example would be what happened with DACA. Deferred Action for Childhood. It's the immigration with children and kids of immigrants coming in.
The Dreamers.
And there was, of course, all kinds of local reaction on that. County council members, county governments, the district mayor, all denounce that. It's a very liberal area around Washington, D.C., which kind of makes the Trump administration a bit like an island here. immediate aftermath was a protest in the streets of Washington. And that is kind of local news in itself because you're closing streets and using police resources. And it's not just sort of the national narrative of this is what they're protesting, but it becomes a local story because they've closed roads. There's police action. Kids are skipping school in a lot of cases. So that then becomes my story. And so I'm covering both the DACA issue and sort of the logistical protesting issues. That's just one example of how the national story ripples into my job.
Has it changed your perspective as a newsman? Do you find yourself these days? Because you again, I think you and I have had the conversation about, you know, real news, fake news, alternative facts.
Yeah.
Has it changed your perspective as a professional when it comes to providing the news to your listeners?
Yeah, I think it's just important to know what kind of sources are out there. And you can have more genuine sources than others. I think the big divide that was really exposed in this election was that some people view some sources as more genuine than other people view the same sources being different levels of genuine. So I think the important thing is to make sure you're doing your research and go to different sources. I mean, I, as a news reporter, I knew that would be a requirement in my job from the beginning, is I can't just see one report off of one website and take it as gospel, go report it as news to our audience of a 6 million people metropolitan area. I have to find multiple sources and verify facts, call people. I'm not necessarily saying you as a news consumer needs to call a person to verify a story, but take in different sources, and that might mean taking in different viewpoints. Just try and balance things out a little bit. It's not necessarily staying within one pond of news.
I have to ask you this. You work for a radio station that it's got conservative tones.
Yes.
How does that affect you as a journalist? Because you and I have had, oddly enough, had to have the conversation during the weekend in regards to, because, again, it is getting tougher to work, because these days it isn't necessarily somebody who is a Republican or somebody who is a liberal or a Democrat, but it's, you know, it's a matter of now we're to the extremes. You've got the alt left, get the alt right.
Mm-hmm.
How does that affect you in going out there and providing the information without it being questioned that, you know, well, you're with that radio station that's, you know, they're conservative. We think that they lean right, but maybe they might be alt-right too.
Yeah, it was definitely kind of a unexpected obstacle to overcome. I think the fact that my station does have a reputation here, and it harkens back to what I said before. This is a very liberal metropolitan area. 93% of D.C. voters went for Hillary Clinton last November. That sort of tells you all you need to know about how much of a Democratic stronghold D.C. is, and so are the Maryland suburbs, so are the Northern Virginia suburbs. So with the reputation that my station has, I kind of needed to build more of a rapport with a lot of my sources, a lot of the politicians here, the Democratic politicians at least, and let them know that the news product this station's putting out is middle of the road, unbiased. We don't lean left or right, at least for the first 6 minutes of every hour. The news is just middle of the road news. The rest of the hour, talk programming does lean conservative on this station, but that's not part of what I'm doing here.
Yeah, because it's definitely interesting. In these days, people expect somebody who is reporting to either be reporting from one favorable stance or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I, like you, I try to be as uber neutral as possible. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me, and maybe you can agree or disagree, it seems like it's becoming more and more difficult to be able to stay on that stance, because you may agree a little bit on your story may have a feel where it's reporting on something that is happening with the Republicans and an initiative that the Republicans are putting forth, and be perceived, oh well, they're reporting to serve the conservative cause. But then again, if you do something that's a little bit more, you know, on the Democrat for the Dems more favorable, then it's like, oh, heresy, you're going against what your station is putting forth.
Right, and it all sort of speaks to the environment that we're in these days, in that, I mean, our president basically started his campaign bringing people together through attacking the media. And
Still, I mean, to this day.
And it's it's led me to obviously be more scrutinizing of my work, which I think is helpful for if it can be applied to other journalists. I think that's helpful that we take a second, third look at what we're doing. But also it's led to a lot of unsubstantiated criticisms, attacks, just a lot of basically more scrutinizing of our work, a lot of it not necessarily fairly. And I basically had to come to the realization and come to the point where I say I can't respond to every attack email I get, every attack tweet that I get, because people just think they have a license now to just go off on journalists. And there are a lot of valid criticisms out there, and I'd love to take constructive criticism, but a lot
as long as it's constructive, right, it's on the fringes of a full on attack of you as an individual who has dedicated your career to it.
Right. And as long as it's constructive, it's fine. But I mean, I had to just stop worrying about, stop responding to every attack I got. We actually got an email in the newsroom a while back from a listener who expected the news product here to lean conservative because that's what the talk programming is. And we had to politely explain that's not how it works here.
Again, that's the voice of Mr. Steve Burns, a good friend, colleague, who is applying his trade as a news reporter and anchor for WMAL, serving the DMV as he finally calls it, and has been a fantastic host over the past couple of days. I've had a chance to kind of take in the sights. He, when I come down and visit him, he becomes my tour guide. We actually go out and about, and we'll share a little bit more about that in just a couple of moments. Here we are going into, you know, the holidays are right around the corner. Do you expect things to get a little quieter in the newsroom? Do you feel as though, I mean, the latest news right now is that there's yet another attempt to try to do something in regards to affordable health care. And the latest news over the weekend was a full-on attack from, you know, the commander-in-chief against John McCain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are you expecting for conversations to be had, or stuff that you've already started looking into as a journalist?
I can't really imagine anything slowing down ever. I feel like it's been since maybe the first week of February. People have been saying, oh, we're finally starting to get back to a normal level here, and things will finally start slowing down. They haven't slowed down since January 20th. As soon as one news cycle is over about whatever the controversy of the day is, there's a new one coming, and then there's another one coming. And like you said, we've had attacks on the senators that have opposed new health care legislation. We've just recently had the attacks on NBA players, NFL players, and these are things that are going to stay in the news cycle for days and days, and they'll get advanced, and more people will talk, and then the news cycle gets advanced further. So I don't feel like anything is, I don't think there's a level of stasis anymore as far as this administration goes. It seems like there's some sort of desire to stay with a fresh news cycle and keep finding fresh things to advance the news cycle with.
When you're out there and you're reporting, you're gathering sound to be able to put together a report, are you noticed out there people recognizing Steve Burns when you're out there with the WMAL mic flag, or you're, you know, asking him questions about whatever the relevant subject of the day was?
Sometimes. It depends on what the audience is of the event I'm at. I was at a pro-Trump rally last weekend on the National Mall, and quite a few people knew my name. If I'm out just on the street talking to random people in Washington, D.C., again, very liberal place, then there's not too much recognition. It depends on the audience, yeah.
And you find yourself covering more and more of these protests.
Right.
Does it get old for you? Do you kind of find that there's a different temperament to each one? And how do you approach it as a journalist, especially in these modern times where it's like every time you turn around, there is a protest and people want to be heard. People are seeking action from either, you know, the government or change.
Right.
What's that like for you as a journalist out there and amongst the people and as they're protesting?
I feel like I sort of definitely had baptism by fire at this job 2 months after I moved here. Freddie Gray, Baltimore happened. I got sent up there as buildings were being set on fire, police cars were being torched. So if I ever have to hit that level again, I'll start getting worried. But I feel like covering a protest on the National Mall, D.C. is so used to these big, high-security events like the inauguration. There was a bit of a blow-up there as far as rioting went, but I don't necessarily fear for my safety. My main concern when I'm out there is I have half-hourly newscasts that I need to fill. So it's more the logistics of what story am I going to tell, and how am I going to tell the story, and am I going to have time to tell the story? Like, it's, I think half my time when I'm out of protest is watching the clock, so I don't have too much time to worry about safety at that point. So, plus, I mean, like I said, DC's police force is very good. And what happened this past weekend was somewhat unique in that we had the pro-Trump rally, didn't draw nearly as many people as they were hoping. I don't think maybe the high watermark there was about 800 people, which is not very high for a National Mall rally. At the same time that you had the pro-Trump people at the Washington Monument, a half mile over at the Lincoln Memorial were the Juggalos, the fans of the Insane Clown Posse. And this is what's great, because I asked the Juggalos and I asked the people there to support President Trump, and both said, this is why we love the First Amendment. This is why we love America. We can get these two groups. They're not necessarily together, but they're on the same plot of land here on the National Mall. They're able to speak their mind peacefully, and it's legal to do that here, and it's not in a lot of other places. So it's kind of a unique and enjoyable thing here.
I didn't really realize that the Insane Clown Posse had gone from creating music to now it's more of a political movement.
It is. Well, that's what happens when the FBI designates you as a gang, apparently. You become a political movement. I think they had some valid grievances there. I mean, it's horrorcore rap. It's kind of violent, but I don't...
So it's in gangster rap. What's your point?
Yeah. I think the majority of Juggalos are good people. You can put me on the record as saying that.
Okay. It depends on their face paint, so to speak.
Right.
Okay.
And there were more Juggalos on the mall than Trump supporters, believe it or not.
Wow.
So you never know what you'll find down there.
Excellent. Now, other than, you know, the nuts and bolts, the, you know, soup to nuts things that you do on a day-to-day basis as a news reporter, I know you love putting together features. Have you had a chance to put together any features while you've been down here? I know one of them was in regards to that fun transit system that you have called the Metro. Do you have anything in the works?
Well, for people that need a primer on the Metro, I thought the T was bad when I lived in Boston, and then I came down here and I saw the Metro. And actually, the day I got hired here at WML, when I took the phone call and my future boss said, we'll take you, was the day of a fatal smoke accident here on Metro. And I remember my boss telling me over the phone, we could have used you today. And I said, yeah, I can see that. Metro's had a lot of problems. I think they're on the upswing right now, but it's just been years and years of neglect. But as far as the feature stories, I do really enjoy human interest stories, kind of like getting down, pinpointing the actual people and like getting into the personality of someone, of like maybe an overarching issue, who is this going to affect, and learning, you know, the microcosm of the issue. And I've had a couple good opportunities to do that. A lot of it, my interest is intersecting with history too. There was one I did recently on the Hanafi siege, which was, I guess you could call it probably one of America's first terrorist attacks, when gunmen took over three different buildings here in D.C. It happened 40 years ago, and my broadcast was on the 40th anniversary, and I talked to some of the politicians that were holed up in their offices. It was a three-day-long event. So I enjoy getting like a fresh take on history. For Memorial Day, D.C. is great because you can connect everything to some historical marker in D.C. For Memorial Day, I went to what was originally Arlington Cemetery before Arlington became what it is today. It's a small army cemetery, and the man who founded Memorial Day is buried there. So anytime I can find a unique piece of history that I can connect to the present day, I really enjoy those stories.
How has this city been for you, being a Jersey kid?
Yes.
You went to school in Boston, you know, you applied your trade at a couple of different radio stations in the Boston area,
yeah,
right?
Yep.
Including our very own 959 WATD. and now you're down here. What has it been like in living in D.C.? I mean, you know, you glow, and I've had a chance to kind of spend time with you down here, but I want you to kind of put it into the words of the folks who have heard, who have listened to you as a broadcaster up in the Boston area now down here in D.C.
Yeah, the one thing I like to really make people aware of is that Washington isn't just the Capitol and the White House and federal politicians. Washington's a city of 650,000 people that has a lot of unique neighborhoods, unique
thriving
shops.
Community.
Yeah, unique personalities. And it's kind of like it's its own character here that nobody ever learns about, because when we hear Washington, all we hear is the federal politics. It's a really, really neat city that has all different kinds of characters and all different types of personality in terms of its different neighborhoods. I love the city. My main complaint I always tell people about D.C. is that it's sort of missing a specialty food. Like everywhere I've lived, Jersey has its pizza. Boston has its clam chowder. Philly has its cheesesteaks. D.C., it's, I don't really know what the signature food here is. If anyone has any ideas, love to hear them.
And I kind of want to kind of build off on the back end of that about doing features. I think you were in on this station, one of the station's award-winning segments or, yes, or series, correct?
Yes, I did a feature on Frank Howard, the feared Washington Senator's slugger from back in the late 60s, early 70s. He was being given an honor by the Washington Nationals, the current baseball team here, honoring baseball's past here in D.C. So I thought that was a fun thing to do. And I got a few comments from a few of my friends in Massachusetts that said, I remember Frank Howard coming to Fenway. He was a feared guy. That was pretty cool.
And during my visits down here, you and I have kind of have a little bit of a kinship when it comes to sports. You and I got to, during this weekend, take in a couple of sporting events. Most notably, I got to go to an O's game, Baltimore Orioles.
Yes.
It was a fun time, and it kind of completed the circle because the last time I was here last year, had a chance to go to a Nationals game.
Yes.
What's it like being, and I joke with you every time I have you on, being an A's fan and knowing that the team is still trying to find an identity, at least try to build character to hopefully be on top of the AL West. What's it like to at least have, you know, so many sports here within walking or driving distance?
Yeah. I mean, going to school in Boston, you know what a sports town is. Just Boston and sports have gone hand in hand forever. But I moved down here, and my first complaint was nobody cares about sports here. It's all just a distraction from whatever jobs people are doing here.
Sure.
But I've learned over the past year, I've kind of had a shift in thinking there, that this is a sports town, but it's just been suffering for so long. The Redskins have just been mired in mediocrity for so long. The Caps have always been just good enough to get to the first or second round, but never longer than that. The Nats were bad for a long time. They might be going somewhere this season. We'll have to see. So it's not that people don't care here. It's just that we're so jaded. It's just been suffering for so long here. But it is cool to have the four major sports teams here and be able to go up to Baltimore and see the AL teams. My dad and I have a tradition. We've done it for 10 years now of us stopping whatever we're doing in the middle of summer whenever the A's visit Baltimore and go see the A's and O's at Camden Yards. So it's good to be around these sports stadiums.
And it was, again, a fun time being somebody who, I am a Red Sox fan, but to be in enemy territory. And you were kind of teasing me as I was walking around the pro shop. And
you want to make signing. This you want to make this public that you actually you,
I only
you actually
about,
got gear for
well,
a,
I bought a hat
an AL East rival.
But here's the thing though, I bought the same thing I bought when I was at the Nats.
I don't see it as an equal though.
I do, because the Nats
are National League. They play the Red Sox every 3 years. The Orioles play the Sox quite often. So good luck with that.
Yeah, but let's not forget, just not too long ago, 4 or 5 days ago, that I believe that the Red Sox handed them their hat.
Yes.
And so basically, I bought myself one of those little tennis caps. I like it. And I like the emblem, but it was a fun time, and I got to thank you, and
absolutely,
and I got to meet a figure the folks know who actually has his own eatery there.
Yes,
right,
Boog's Barbecue. And the best part about Boog's barbecue is that Boog is always there shaking hands.
And it was funny because we're walking, he goes, hey, Boog's here. I'm like, what? You're messing with me. He goes,
and
no.
I had to explain.
No, he's right
to you,
there.
Former American League MVP, Boog Powell, is right there.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, I'll take a picture.
Yeah. It isn't like you said, hey, Dustin Pedroia, because I would know who that is because he was a former, you know, MVP guy too.
But he can't walk around anymore with his knees, so I just, you wouldn't see him on the concourse.
But what was even better is that, again, you had an idea to go to the game, and we went up. There was a book festival, which was fantastic. And what was ongoing at that time as well?
Just by pure luck, the planets aligned just for you. There was a Comic-Con going on at the convention center.
Yes. Yes, and you figured you would torment me, seeing that we had spent time not too long ago in California.
Right, Los Angeles.
And I had to tell you that horrific story about being accosted for a dollar.
Yeah.
By a Batman.
No, I was there for that.
Yeah.
And I warned, I think I warned you beforehand.
You did.
And I said, these guys are just here to make a buck.
That's right. I forgot you were there. We had, what was the name of that restaurant we went to? I forgot about that.
Something with a
pig and pork or something.
Some pig. I don't remember.
It was pretty good though.
Yeah.
They had, like the window, they had like the.
But if you hadn't stopped and talked to the Batman, you'd have an extra few bucks to spend at the restaurant.
I know. I know. I forgot that you were there.
Yeah.
That's right, but you were there for my second Batman sighting and actually took the picture.
Yeah, and that guy didn't shake you down, so.
He didn't shake me down, but they wouldn't let me buy a T-shirt at the Comic-Con. That was a disappointing thing. Steve, I got to thank you. We just got about a minute or two left. Anything you want to say to the folks up in the Boston area in regards to not only missing broadcasting in the Boston area on a regular basis, or just kind of, you know, set their mind at ease as to what's going on down here in the nation's capital?
Yes. Well, I will never forget the start and the opening that I got at WATD, and it's just been excellent from there. And the people that took a chance on me at WATD, I'll be forever grateful to them. And all the people that I've heard from over my time at WATD that said they enjoy the work that we do, and since then, and I'm glad that you have stayed in touch, and it means a lot to me that you would make a trip down here again to see me. So thank you again for the opportunity. Well, thank you for coming.
We've actually plotted, we're actually plotting to maybe do something and maybe expand upon just you coming up to Boston and going to a sporting event and me coming down here to a sporting event, that we might even kind of look, take our horizons to maybe other cities and towns.
Yes, there's some options out there. We're looking forward to it.
There he is, former WATD anchor now with the WMAL. Steve Burns has been my guest for this portion of Monday Night Talk. We're going to step aside for a moment and more program right here at 959 WATD. Don't go anywhere.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
It happened at the supermarket, November 20th, 1993, a Saturday. Most people do not buy duck. We are not a duck-eating people. Who thinks of duck? College quarterback Dick Wright did. On impulse, he pulled a nice frozen duck out of the freezer. But then he noticed it had the shape and the feel of a football. Cold as Green Bay, but a football. So on his way out, there's his brother by the pickup, about 35 yards. Bill gets a grip on that duck. He faints toward the end zone. His brother goes wide left, and that frozen duck had the ride of its life. That wobbling duck just flew. It smashed through the fingertips of the wide receiver and demolished the windshield of Sal Roseo's 89 Firebird. You just can't put a good spiral on a frozen duck.
I'm Tiny of Tiny & Sons Glass. We come to your work or home, and we fix your windshield. Your insurance company covers it. 1-888-64-TINIES. Just call.
My dad did a great job.
Monday Night Talk continues all week long. Go to 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk and keep in touch on Facebook and Twitter. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome back to the final segment of Monday Night Talk. Hope you enjoyed that segment with Steve Brown. Again, remind folks that was taped at the WMAL studios in D.C., courtesy of the fine folks down there, and, of course, my media colleague, Steve Burns. It was excellent hanging out with him. Now, we turn our focus from talking with Mr. Burns to talking with a couple of things that we're doing for this final segment. We're going to start off talking with Holly Brown, who's here with me right now. She is the executive director of Looking and Feeling Fab, and I was fortunate enough to have her great husband, JJ, give me a call, contact me, and say, hey, what would you think about having a conversation about this this fantastic... is this a fundraiser, if I'm correct, Holly?
Yep, it's a fundraiser. So I founded a nonprofit 501c3 public charity called Looking and Feeling Fab. And our mission is to provide comfort and relief for people who have undergone treatment for cancer and develop serious, moderate to serious skin side effects. And we're licensed estheticians, oncology trained to be able to treat the different side effects that we see, such as dryness, redness, rash, etc.
And just as I'll throw it out there once or twice during this segment, do you want to find out more? www.lookfeelfab.org. And again, Holly is here kind of chatting. What got you involved? How did this come to be? What's the genesis of this organization?
Sure. So I suffer from multiple sclerosis as well as sarcoidosis, which is a lung disease. And I was diagnosed with sarcoidosis actually while I was in school to become an esthetician. And because of the two autoimmune diseases, the doctors felt the best form of treatment was chemotherapy. So I have an 8-hour infusion of chemotherapy every 6 months. And I just saw what it did to my skin. I had acne. I had never had acne before. I developed a serious rash. My skin started splitting in areas. And I had heard about the oncology aesthetics training, which at the time was only about 3 years in its infancy. And so they didn't offer it around here. They only offered it on the western part of the country. So I went to Arizona and received my training and came back and said, wow, I'd love to start a nonprofit. And everybody kind of doubted me and said, oh, you know, nobody would ever go for it. And because I'm so pigheaded, I put my mind to it and submitted my paperwork and I ended up getting it. And that was about 4 years ago.
I think the word you want to use is driven.
I guess, yeah. Driven. That's probably better.
And there's nothing, wrong with being driven and having a certain focus for a certain thing. Now, so you have an event that's actually going to be coming up this Thursday. Tell us a little bit about it. From what I understand, it's going to be in Weymouth, and you got a spirit medium who is going to be there as well.
Yes. So I don't know how much people know about spirit mediums, but they have a special talent that they can communicate with our loved ones that have passed onto the other side. And so we will be having a fundraiser with, her name is Laura Emerald, and she's coming, and it will be an open forum, and whatever spirits come through, she will address. So we look forward to that. She's great. I've had a personal reading myself, and my mother came through, and she recited a story to me that happened when I was younger that there was no way she would have known. And she pretty much told the story to me verbatim.
Okay. And how much are you hoping to raise from the event? If folks want to get tickets, and we'll repeat it because it's early on in the conversation, but I think being repetitive, it gives folks an opportunity to at least write it down, or if they didn't catch it the first time, the second time, if you will, what are you looking to raise from this event?
I guess we are looking to raise possibly maybe around 5,000 or so. We are limited in the tickets to 150, and the tickets are $40. They can be purchased at eventbrite.com, and the event's called Messages from Heaven. You can also visit our website, and there's a link on there in order to purchase tickets.
What's your mission in regards to this organization? Is it just a matter of comfort of life, quality of life for folks who are, you know, suffering from what you have?
Yep. So basically when people undergo treatment for cancer, such as, you know, chemotherapy, radiation. So in particular, the treatment is geared to kill off the cancer cells. But because the technology can't decipher between the good cells and the bad cells. And because your skin is all made up of cells, we see that one common reaction is with the skin. So there can be a number of different reactions, dryness. People can develop radiation burns, and you can get acne. You could get hyperpigmentation, which is the discoloration. So and some people don't really understand, but this can affect people's quality of life. So you have the stresses of everyday life, then you have a cancer diagnosis on top of that, and now you have these sores all over your face. And so it becomes a different aspect for people who are going through this, because now they don't want to go out into the community and they're embarrassed and people will know that they're sick. And so we do our best to give them relief from the symptoms, and we've seen amazing results.
And people don't realize how important our skin is, do they?
No, not at all. Unfortunately, you know, the skin is the largest organ of the body. We give so much more emphasis on our other organs. If we felt something in our heart, we would run to the doctors. And the skin is very important. It actually contributes to our overall health and well-being. So it's very important to take care of it. In this country, we don't put as much emphasis on how important it is.
What do you look to do with the monies that you raise? Is it a matter of being able to go out and acquire different creams and solutions to help people who are dealing with these skin-related issues?
Yep, that's a part of it. 100% of the proceeds go right to the foundation. So that enables us to offer free program and free treatments for services for people. We have a wellness program that entitles people to 5 free treatments, and we educate them how to care for their skin, because now that they've undergone treatment for cancer, we say their skin is compromised, and from that point forward it will always be compromised. So taking care of compromised skin becomes a little bit of a different battle. And so we train them how to avoid chemicals, ways to use essential oils, the precautions that they need now in the sun, etc. And so we do a lot of education with it as well.
Yeah, we're speaking with Holly Brown, and she is the executive director, founder of Looking and Feeling Fab, and she is my guest here for the next couple of minutes to talk a little bit about the genesis of the organization and the assistance that the organization offers. We talked a little bit about the upcoming event this Thursday in Weymouth. Let's remind folks again, and again, we talked about the spirit medium, Laura Emerald will be there. What else will be going on at this event? And again, repeat where the event is so folks know.
Yeah, sure. So the event's going to be at Hajjaz in Weymouth. I believe the address is 969 Washington Street.
That's correct.
And
it's only because I'm holding it in my hand.
Tickets can be purchased on eventbrite.com. And the event is called Messages from Heaven. Tickets are $40. We will not be selling tickets at the door, so please go online and get your tickets. You can also go to our website. There's a link on our website that will bring you right to the event page to purchase tickets.
I think that's important that you mention that, because that was the first thing that my eyes went down to, is like the tickets will not be sold at the door, and I'm glad that you mentioned that, so folks will know that at least they're being warned.
Yes, yes.
Don't show up without a ticket. You can go online and be able to purchase. You go to the website as well, www.lookfeelfab.org. What if individuals can't attend this event, but you would like to assist the efforts of the organization?
Sure. So they could just go right onto our website, and we would appreciate volunteers. We have different fundraisers at different points during the year, and we can always use help running those or doing those. And also, we always need people to kind of spread the word. We are the first nonprofit of its kind in the country. Since we've been inception, there have been three others across the country that have began to come up and flourish, who I actually had mentored and helped start. So the more that they pop up around the country, the more awareness becomes of how important of a subject this is. So we are the first one of its kind. So it's been basically us blazing the trails to educate people in the community, those with cancer, people in the medical community, and just really try to make people known of our services.
How does it feel to know that you've inspired other people to, again, being the founder, and then all of a sudden a couple of other organizations want to follow, a couple of other individuals want to follow suit and have similar nonprofits like yours?
It's awesome. It's so awesome. People say, "Are you afraid that they're competition?" And I say, "No, because the more awareness that's brought to the subject, the better we will all be." And so I share everything that I've gone through and everything that I've learned with new people that are starting these nonprofits. And I just think it's wonderful. And the more word that can be spread and the more people who can be educated about this condition and the more people who can be treated and know about our services, the better.
And if I could just kind of throw this in, and it's not necessarily some show of, being on the program, it's a show of support, but it's kind of to empathize. I'm not somebody who has cancer or has gone through that, but I'm somebody who I have eczema from time to time. And it's one of those things that it's a quality of life thing. And again, this is just part of my, it's part of nature for me that I'll get it every so often that it pops up and I have to find a way to deal with it. Think of if somebody, is going through, they've found out that they have something internally wrong and they're going seeking treatment, and then they're having even more issues on top of it with their skin. Think of how important it is that there's an organization that's willing to help those people at least give the quality of life to somebody who is already suffering enough with something
right
internally.
Right. It becomes, to be an esthetician is very rewarding in itself, but then this becomes a different type of appreciation and thankfulness, and it's just very, very rewarding. It helps me to deal with my issues that I have and kind of put everything in perspective. And, my estheticians are fantastic, and they all do a great job, and the praise that we get from people is, like, amazing. And it takes on a different type of importance when somebody else has other things that are going on.
I want to thank you and JJ for joining us. JJ has been kind of the silent partner today, but he was the one who initially reached out to me. We got less than a minute left before we change directions and have another conversation, but anything I haven't asked you but you feel is important to tell in the listeners who are listening to Monday Night Talk at this particular moment?
I don't think so. I think we pretty much covered everything. If I may, today is my sister's birthday. If I can just give a little shout out to her.
Happy birthday,
Tracy. And so, like I said, we're just looking for people to become aware and spread the word about us and people to know that it's available. We are also associated with Signature Healthcare, Brockton Hospital. They have implemented the program over there where they give their patients a certificate. So the doctors over there and personnel are fully in support of our program. They've seen some of the results that we've had. And so it's going good. But the more people we can get involved and the more word we can spread, the better.
JJ Hawley, thank you very much for joining us here this segment. Folks, just a reminder, you want to find out more information, check out the website, find out about their event coming up this Thursday from 6 to 10 p.m. in Weymouth, Haja's Bar and Grill. And you can also check out the website, www.lookfeelfab.org. It's that easy to find out more information.
Thank you so much.
We transition now from speaking in studio with Hawley Brown to the phone lines. And joining us right now is Melita Mel Arredondo, and she's here to chat with us about the Arredondo Foundation that has been created, actually the Arredondo Family Foundation, a number of things to talk about. As folks may or may not know, September is Suicide Prevention Month. As you know, we have done a couple of segments on this show this month, and when this was proposed to me as to doing a segment, I felt it was important to be able to do this. And Mel's joining us on the phone line. Ms. Arredondo, well, welcome to Monday Night Talk.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. If you'd be so kind to give us kind of an overview of the creation of the Arredondo Family Foundation, how did it come to be?
Well, there's a lot of work that we did prior to forming the foundation in 2015. A year after Lance Corporal Alexander Arredondo, my stepson, was killed, my husband and I went to work supporting veterans' issues and also military family issues. And then we ended up losing my younger stepson, Brian, in 2011. So it brought it to home, and he died by suicide. So it ended up hitting us, the issue of suicide hit us in the face and in the heart. Not too long after that, we were still trying to process the fact that both boys were gone. The Boston Marathon bombing happened.
Right.
And in some ways, it was a distraction from our grief. In other ways, it sort of messed up our heads, but in sort of a good way. What happened is that Carlos became a media sensation, and people keep calling him. People keep calling him to this day. So we sort of looked at each other and said, you know, because we were still helping families who had lost somebody to a military suicide, and we said, you know what, this would be easier rather than going door to door and knocking when a military suicide happens, to just have a fund. So in early 2015, the Boston Athletic Association, who runs the Boston Marathon, provided entries into the marathon, and from that we were able to raise our first $25,000. And I did the paperwork for incorporation and all that stuff. We've got our 501c3 in 2016, and that is how we have been doing our work. Our programs primarily come from our own life experience. So there is emergency funds for families who've lost someone to a military-related suicide. There are scholarships for the military siblings. And our most recent program, which began a year ago, is called QPR. It is a suicide prevention program that is done in about an hour.
Mm.
And we provide that for free for people all in Massachusetts. Right now we're working primarily with fire departments and police departments to get them this training and talk to them about the three populations that we work with, because we work with veterans who are dying at 20 a day, with military, we focus on active duty, which are dying at one a day, and then there's the unknown of the family members who are also dying by suicide, as we experienced.
Yeah, we're speaking with Melita Arredondo, Executive Director of the Arredondo Family Foundation, both her and her husband, Carlos, the ones who are part of this, who were the founders of this. If I could back you up just for half a second.
You bet.
You mentioned an acronym, QPR. Could you explain that real quick to folks?
Sure. It's meant to be a synonym to CPR, which saves people if they have a heart issue. QPR is question, persuade, refer. And it mainly talks about how you can ask somebody the question, or if they're thinking of suicide. Persuade is the conversation, which is so needed in order to listen to the person who is struggling with their issues. And then refer is the part where you actually know where to lead this person next. This is not a form of counseling. It's more a form of active listening in an emergency situation, and then knowing where to have this person go in order to get the appropriate services.
How important has getting the word out and the message of the foundation, especially during this month, Suicide Prevention Month?
We have done, at this point, perhaps 8 trainings with police and fire departments. We also did a one-day in the office train the trainer, which means there are now more people who are able to do this training. We certified 8 people more. And that we will do that again in January. So for us, it is a priority. Last night we were at a veterans event, my husband and I, and we said, you know, we explained to them what we were doing, and if anybody would like to have these trainings happen to them or want to learn how to be a trainer, that they should contact us for the opportunity. We are doing this at no cost. And as I mentioned earlier, our fundraising initially and continues to be through marathons. As a matter of fact, Carlos and I are going to the Marine Corps Marathon, but they also have a 10K for us. And that'll be on October 22nd, and we're each raising funds. So that is where our money comes from these athletic opportunities, and so that we can be able to continue at no cost providing these trainings, as well as the scholarships, as well as emergency funds to families who have lost someone to a military suicide.
If you could take a moment, Mel, to tell us a little bit about a special event coming up this Thursday. I believe that there's going to be a ceremony in Jamaica Plain. Could you tell us a little bit about it?
Yes. It's at the corner of River Street and Huntington. So it's sort of like at that J.P. Boston Brookline triangle right there.
Right.
There's a bridge that everybody goes over on the Jamaica Way, and it will the state is honoring us, both the Foley and the Arredondo families, with the renaming of a bridge that will be called the Lance Corporal Alexander Arredondo and Brian Arredondo Memorial Bridge for both boys, and it will be at 11 a.m. We invite people to come. It means a lot to us, especially Carlos, who remembers having to take his first wife in when she was giving birth to the hospital, and then bringing the bundles of joy and his former wife home, all going over that bridge.
Talk to me about, I mean, how much you kind of talked about it and just encapsulated in regards to, you know, bringing you know, those boys home. While this doesn't bring them back, at least does what in your eyes and Carlos's eyes, that it's being recognized, their efforts as folks in the military. Give me your thoughts.
Well, for to know that they are remembered,
right?
It pretty much is. For any family member who has the loss, they want their loved ones to be remembered. I think it could be, from my point of view, it's amplified being a stepmother, wanting any parent who has lost a child really wants them remembered. So my husband likes to say, I don't care if they remember me, I just want them to remember Alex and Brian. So, and I have to agree with that. They were here for a short amount of time, but their legacy inspired both the Arredondo Family Foundation, and we're fortunate that Governor Baker and the folks in the State House passed this bill into law so that we can remember them on a structure that many people use.
If you could, Mel, give us, is there a website if folks want to get involved, whether you're looking for volunteers, whether you're looking for donations, or maybe there's a department out there that wants that specialized QPR training.
So, yes. The address is, you have to know how to spell our last name, though.
That's Kate.
It's arredondofoundation.org, and Arredondo is spelled A2Rs, E, D like dog, O, N like Nancy, D like dog, O, foundation.org.
Okay. And I also want to give you a moment while we got just a couple of moments left here with Melita Arredondo of the Arredondo Family Foundation. Could you tell us a little bit about the Marine Corps Marathon that's going to be taking place down in D.C. on October 22nd?
Well, this will be Carlos's second 10K. He got to go a few years ago. When he came back and he said that there was this memorial mile, and those who have fallen in the Marine Corps are there. I definitely felt like I really wanted to do it someday. So someday happened this year, but I do have a proviso, okay, which is that I just had a hip replacement surgery on July 7th. Okay, so I've already done 2 5Ks, and my most recent one I did it in about 52 minutes, and this is part of my recovery to be able to walk, run, more emphasis on walk, the 10K at the Marine Corps Marathon. That means a lot to us, and we have a team of 30 people going from the Arradondo Family Foundation. They've signed up in one way or another. About half of them are doing the whole marathon, and the other half are doing the 10K. And like I said earlier, they're all raising some funds, and much-needed funds. And we have some upcoming events that those funds will go to. One is that we do a turkey giveaway, and we will be doing it in several parts of the state, both for veterans and military families. We provide turkey with the fixings, and et cetera. It's uncooked, but this will be the third year we're doing it. And we also have the holidays coming up, so we tend to look after the families who've had their most recent losses to suicide, military suicide, and we help with their Christmas, which is burdensome otherwise.
Well, I want to thank you for being a part of this this segment this evening, and we look forward to hopefully talking to Carlos in the coming weeks and months, and keeping it fresh in folks' minds in regards to suicide prevention, and also as well as the Arradondo Family Foundation's, the organization itself, and the fine work that it does. We got less than 30 seconds. Anything you want to say quickly in closing?
If you suspect that somebody is having a hard time, ask the question. It can be really difficult. Ask the question, how are you feeling? Are you thinking of harming yourself? That if the answer comes back positive, listen. Encourage them to talk and listen to what they have to say. And if you can remember the phone number 1-800-877-TALK, that is the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. And that would be a great place to refer anyone to.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Mel. I really appreciate your time here on the program.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you folks for tuning in tonight. That's all the program that we have. And we want to thank all our great guests who were part of the show. We're going to step aside, and we'll look forward to talking to you again next week at 6:15 p.m. Until next time, you've been listening to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.